Welcome to This Is Probably a Really Weird Question, the podcast where a medical doctor
and a doctor of history talk about sex, history, and the not at all weird questions we hear from patients, students, and colleagues about our bodies and our sexualities.
I'm Dr. Ronnie Hione.
And I'm Professor Rebecca Davis.
And today's question is,
do I have undiagnosed adult ADHD? This could be the life changer, Ronnie. This could be the thing that catapults us to fame.
And towards early retirement. I'm stretching it out. I realize that the more time I spend in front of my computer, like hunched like a shrimp in front of my computer monitor, the more I need to just like, oh yeah, I have a spine and I should use it. I should, you know,
sit up straight. Join us. Reach your hands to the sky.
Listeners, join us. Raise your fists in the air in revolution.
Yes, do the revolutionary backstretch. Protest and work out those kinks in your neck.
Find your sits bones and also your middle fingers.
Ground your sits bones as your middle fingers rise. Yes. Okay.
Feel the rage.
We should do a workout video. We could totally do protest workout.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
I think it would.
Have you seen that? Somebody put it, there was this thing like circulating on the internets at some point about like reasons to work out that have nothing to do with losing weight, and things that were on there were like, be able to punch Nazis harder, or run away from the cops faster, or have better sex.
Yeah. Yes. All excellent reasons to exercise.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just plug a couple exciting things going on.
Plug away.
One is that I've started a newsletter over at the Substack, and it's called Carnal Knowledge, and it's free. Mm-hmm. So if you want to subscribe, you can get a sort of weekly newsletter. It's weekly now, but I'm also on sabbatical, so we'll see what happens when I'm back in the saddle of the fall semester. But I'm going to write it pretty regularly. And it basically is taking, when we see these headlines about related to sex and sexuality, I'm trying to sort of work our way back to figuring out how we got there. So it's looking at some of the history behind the debates we're having today over sex and sexuality. So we'd love it if you join the conversation. Mm-hmm. And again, that's over at Substack. It's called Carnal Knowledge. And we can link to it in our show notes.
Yes, please.
The other thing is that the ever wonderful Foundation for Delaware County, our fiscal sponsor, is hosting this 24-hour Delco. Delco is how us locals say Delaware County.
Oh.
Delco Gives Day. And it's May 8th through 9th, and it is for all kinds of nonprofits in the area, and we're going to have targeted opportunities to donate and contribute. So, friends, if you go to delcogives.org, you can find all of these wonderful organizations there, including ours, and there's going to be a festival at Rose Tree Park, for those of you who are local to Delaware County, PA, and there's going to be a big bash in Rose Tree Park the evening of May 9th with food trucks and music, and then booths with all of these amazing nonprofits to share information and talk about what they do. So I'm going to be there at a really weird question table, handing out info and talking to people about what we do on this podcast and why we love it. So thank you, thank you, thank you to everybody who's donated to the podcast. It's fully tax deductible charitable donation. And it really helps us do this podcast. So there are my plugs for the day.
Thanks for plugging that.
Ronnie, I'm super excited about the question that we're talking about today. And one of the reasons I'm so excited is sort of personal. One of my roles as a professor in a history department is that every so often I have the amazing, wonderful privilege of working with graduate students. And more than once, I've had one of these brilliant people tell me, I'm going to be able to start making those writing deadlines because I just found out that I have ADHD, and for the first time I'm getting medication and can sit and read a book and can sit, you know, and write. And it's changed the lives of these graduate students. They have suddenly mm-hmm. been able to do, you know, you could already tell in conversation with them. Like, they could sit with us in a seminar room or in my office hours and put all the pieces together, right? They could take what they'd read from three or four different books, synthesize it, add their own reflection. All the pieces were there. And then they had these tremendous struggles to put it on paper and get it done, complete the work.
Yeah.
And this was a real, this was also a revelation to me to try to understand how to help students, you know, because this happens a lot. You see a lot of just super, you know, creative, smart people get so stuck. And, you know, you worry when you're supervising a person like that in any capacity, am I not giving the right, how can I help this person? It seems like I'm telling them kind of, here are the steps, here's what you need to do. And I know that they understand that entirely. And I know that they are fully capable of this. What's happening that makes it so, and they're, and often when I talk with these people, they're like in agony. They're like, they feel terrible. Their self-esteem is just in the toilet because they're like, I'm a failure. I can't get the work done. And then you realize, no, actually you really needed some help. There was actually a medical issue going on. But that is the full extent of what I know about adult ADHD.
I mean, I feel like that could be it. You may have just like done the episode in a 1 minute intro. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Can I put MD after my name now?
I know one thing.
But I don't actually know what it is. That's the only piece of it that I understand. Like, what is it that, like, so you've had patients ask you this question, you said quite a lot. And I'm so curious, like, who are the patients that are coming to you asking you this question? Like, what's going on for them?
Oh my God, so many things. So I'll start perhaps with maybe the landscape, right? So the majority, just as like a background slash caveat, right? I am a doctor. I am not your doctor, listener. So if you have questions about your own, you know, neuro spiciness, please talk to your doctor. I am not here to give you medical advice. That's the caveat.
Okay, so neuro spiciness is the subtitle of today's episode.
Neuro spiciness. Yes. Yeah. So ADHD stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, right? And a lot of what we know about ADHD comes from studying kids, actually. Mm. So in fact, there are no evidence-based primary care guidelines, practice guidelines for adult ADHD in the United States.
Wait, none?
None. There are only practice guidelines for children. And, you know, historically, in the way, way, way back times, we used to think that like kids would grow out of ADHD and that as they got older, it would go away. And so much of the research and clinical guidelines are focused on children and adolescents, right? So the other kind of seed I want to plant at the beginning of this episode is, you know, maybe have some compassion for the doctors, right? Because to be honest, I really didn't get good training at all on diagnosing and treating adults. A lot of my current practice model is based on like both clinical experience and personal experience and kind of how I have changed the way that I think about ADHD and treatment. But tons of us don't get any training specifically about adults. And the majority of us are making decisions based on our own comfort level, right? And our own comfort level is going to be impacted by a gajillion things, right? Like it's going to be impacted on by like how we feel about stimulants, how we feel about, you know, is ADHD in adults real, air quotes, or not. I think capitalism also has a lot to do with how we feel about ADHD and feeling like someone's value comes solely from their ability to be productive, right? And so, you know, if you have a doctor who's not listening to you, that fucking sucks and that shouldn't happen. And also, it could be that they are just lacking in some kind of basic education, right? So, you know, what we know about diagnosis in children is that there's a humongous gender divide. And I'm going to speak mainly about cisgender kids, right? So cisgender boys are diagnosed with ADHD about 3 times more than girls. And then when we get to adulthood, the ratio is actually closer to 1 to 1. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we're getting better at diagnosing it in adulthood? Or does it mean that we're screwing it up earlier? And I suspect that we're missing a lot of cis girls earlier than, as opposed to like suddenly getting better at diagnosing and treating ADHD in adulthood.
Okay, so I have 2 questions.
Please.
The research I was doing on this, one of the things I noticed right away was that when physicians were trying to figure out how to deal with ADHD in the 1950s, 1960s, there was one school of thought that said you should give people tranquilizers, right, to calm them down. Oh. And then there was another school of thought that tried the stimulants. To me, my unmedically trained brain doesn't quite understand why a stimulant would help treat ADHD. And so I need that. Mm-hmm. I'm actually really curious about. And the other thing is, like, why are we missing girls, right? Like, what is it about what we think ADHD looks like that our gender stereotypes about the differences between boys and girls shapes, you know, which kids we see it in?
Mm-hmm. I suspect that it's a combination of things, just like most things, right? So I suspect that we are seeing it or diagnosing it in boys more frequently than girls for a couple of reasons. Could it have to do with just like early brain development? Sure. Like in how early brain development impacts your behavior? Maybe. I'm not a neurobiologist, but I suspect that that could play a role. I also suspect that socialization has a lot to do with it, right? So the kind of boys will be boys. Oh, that boy is so wild. Look at him running around. He's so strong and loves sports, right? I think some of that externalization of inattention is more noticeable maybe to teachers and family members, right? Like if you have a kid who cannot sit still and is always like revving and fidgeting and can't stay in their seat, I think that's probably more noticeable than a kid who has more internalized symptoms, right? Like distraction or having a difficult time organizing information in their brain, things like that. So yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with what sort of behavioral expectations we have for children based on their gender or presumed gender, and also kind of what is more disruptive to the people around them.
Yeah. All right. That makes a lot of sense.
And then in terms of like, why do stimulants work? I think it has to do with, this is not my area of expertise, but we think that stimulants work through lots of different mechanisms, but probably the biggest effect is the way that it allows your brain to have more effective use of its dopamine, right? And dopamine is a neurotransmitter that plays a big role in like pleasure and reward and also memory and motivation and attention. And so if your brain is not effectively using dopamine, then that makes it difficult to have motivation and attention and memory. So that's why we think that stimulants work. You know, oftentimes people will talk about one of the reasons that they feel like they might have undiagnosed adult ADHD is that they're often kind of seeking like little dopamine hits, whether through like scrolling or eating certain things that give them pleasure. And so sometimes people will say, I feel like I'm just like constantly seeking reward. And it makes me wonder if I could have ADHD.
This is so fascinating. So thank you. So the answer is dopamine. And
the answer is dopamine. It's always dopamine.
Dopamine and gender bias.
There you go. Yeah, is the answer to everything. I think, you know, like many... I'm going to call ADHD like a neurodevelopmental diagnosis because that's oftentimes how we think about it in children.
Okay.
And we know that our brains continue to develop into adulthood and we have, you know, plasticity in our brains. Like many neurodevelopmental conditions, we don't know 100% what causes ADHD. we think that there's probably multiple areas of the brain that are involved, specifically those that use that operate under those dopamine or dopaminergic systems. We also think that environmental exposure and influence can play a role. So sometimes we talk about like epigenetics, and I can't remember if we've talked about epigenetics on this podcast in the past, but basically epigenetics is when you have this interplay of environmental and genetic factors, right? So usually your environment does not actually change your DNA, right? It doesn't make genetic changes, but it can change how DNA is read, the sequence is read by your body, right? So sometimes we think about like trauma, right, as being an epigenetic influence. And so we do think that there is some epigenetic or some environmental influences on ADHD expression, but I don't think we know exactly what those are. And, you know, our whole genetic system is really responsive to inputs. And so I think the more we learn about just epigenetics and brain function in general, the more we'll understand ADHD in the future.
So it sounds to me like if you're an adult and you have this question, there's some reassurance here that like there is a reason why you're confused or questioning about why you have this diagnosis is because like even clinicians aren't entirely sure sort of what it is. And it also makes me think that if you go to a physician or a nurse practitioner or somebody who's very dismissive of the reality of your symptoms, that it might be suggestive of getting to a different caregiver, a different healthcare professional, because it does seem that like a clinician's own clinical experience is going to shape whether they know how to recognize symptoms of adult ADHD and and options for treating it. I didn't realize it was so subjective in adults. It's because it's so, you know, this is a different topic for a different day, this idea that there's this epidemic of ADHD or overprescription of medication to kids, and there's a whole separate conversation about that. But that's where it feels like it's really documented, and it's very, there's books about it and all this focus. But for adults, it does seem to be a bit more of a question mark about what all of it is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think folks who have previously not had a diagnosis of ADHD oftentimes are hesitant to even bring it up, because similar to other things like gender identity, they have had not great experiences in the healthcare system where somebody's really dismissive and says, that's not what this is. You do not have undiagnosed adult ADHD, you're just depressed, or you have anxiety, or, you know, you need therapy, or, you know, and I think everybody deserves a good therapist. We're living in like a dystopian nightmare right now, and I think everybody deserves a good therapist regardless. And non-medication approaches can be really helpful to ADHD, but I think there's a lot of, what is the word I want to use? There's a lot of like eye rolling, I think, among clinicians right now. Like if you're hanging out in the break room, there's a lot of like, how many people did you see today that like self-diagnosed themselves with ADHD from TikTok, right? And there's this kind of gestalt of like, patients are being unduly influenced by social media. And I feel like people are going to get information in the ways that are most accessible to them, right? And social media is incredibly accessible, probably too accessible. And people are just doing the best they can. It really can be quite complicated to like pull those threads apart, right? Because anxiety can look like ADHD and ADHD can look like anxiety, right? So if you have uncontrolled ADHD, and you can't get anything done, and you're feeling panicked because you might lose your job, or you're like, can't meet your writing deadlines for your history professor who you adore, then of course you're going to feel anxious, right? But also, if you have uncontrolled anxiety, it's going to make it really hard to focus and do what you need to get done. Right. And so it can be really difficult to peel those threads apart. And so sometimes we talk about like, let's kind of like jump in somewhere. My practice style, I think, is to do some digging and see if I can figure out if there is more than one thing going on. starting someone on medication, specifically starting stimulants for ADHD, has its own kind of like trials and tribulations. And oftentimes patients don't want to go there immediately, to be honest. Sometimes patients are like, I really don't want to take stimulants if I don't have to. So sometimes we'll start somewhere else. We'll say, well, let's see if we can't get your mood a little bit first, better first, right? Let's see if we can't either get you in with a therapist and or get you started on some medication to help with your mood and see if some of that inattention gets better. And if we're able to manage your mood symptoms and you're like, oh, I'm actually like functioning at my job and I feel great, then we don't even have to go there. But if we get people's mood symptoms under better control and they're still like, I feel like I'm totally failing at everything because I can't get my shit together, then maybe it's worth starting a specific ADHD medication.
That's really helpful to hear it broken down that way. My understanding too is that cis women as adults are often, for any variety of real underlying medical issues, often dismissed as being anxious. And that, like, this can be, I think I read something like it was a heart attack, like women like presenting in emergency rooms, basically having heart attacks and being sent home and told that they were just anxious. So it's like all the ways that these gendered norms around, you know, what is, oh, that's just a hysterical female, right? Or that's just, that's just a lazy little girl who can't, you know, turn in her homework versus like, no, these are real issues going on. Oh, so fascinating.
Yeah. You know, when I was digging into some of the research around ADHD in adults, interestingly, a lot of the research about ADHD in adults is around women and parenting and how ADHD can impact their parenting and how it can impact their children. And I have a lot of feelings as a parent about all this stuff, but, you know, there's some data that says that adults with ADHD, specifically mothers, like they didn't look at fathers, interestingly, but specifically mothers, will say that they feel way less effective as a parent and that they have overreactivity, so more emotional lability and less involvement in their children's lives relative to mothers without ADHD. And that ADHD can sometimes impact your positive parenting or negative parenting, right? So if you are very critical of your kid all the time, that's considered negative parenting. And that mothers with ADHD tend to be more negative parents. Being a parent is really exhausting. And being a parent right now is incredibly exhausting because the amount, I mean, her emails, right? It's just like the amount of emails that come in from everywhere, from like schools and healthcare providers and like playdate, blah. I mean, I also am not always at my best, right?
I was not prepared for the forms. I was completely unprepared for the number of forms required to be a parent in today's world. Like,
I have to say, as somebody who often has to co-sign those forms, I was prepared for the forms. I was not prepared for the emails.
Yeah. I almost lost it about halfway through my older kid's kindergarten year because there was the Home and School Association, there was the classroom, there was the aftercare program. And they all had different days when there was some like, come to school and see your kid do this. And I lost it and was like, so I work and it would be great. Like, if you could tell me all the times for the year when parents are invited to come in so I could promise my kid that, yes, I will be there for these two or three so that he isn't constantly disappointed when I tell him that, no, I can't be there for that. Like, and it's also hard to know, like, what are the important ones? What are the unimportant ones? Like, I mean, if I could go back, there are things that I said no to that I would go to now. So, and the advice I got was to learn how to keep a calendar and get better friends from the Home and School Association person that I emailed at the time.
Get better friends? What does that mean?
Like friends who have like slightly older kids who could advise me about these things. And the irony was, at the time, I was a faculty coach for productivity and work-life balance. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm pretty good at all that. But I just... Just these emails are overwhelming.
The
anyway.
Audacity.
So, you know, we're talking about sort of the gender bias around all of this. And needless to say, a lot of that's been part of the whole framework for defining what ADHD is, figuring out, mm-hmm. you know, what causes it. And a lot of times in psychiatry, you can largely group the schools of thought into two bundles. There's the, it's sort of psychoanalytic, it's your subconscious, it is something that can be dealt with through talk therapy and so on, or that it is biological, it is organic to the brain, the body, and so on. And so there was some thinking initially, so go back like 1930s, 1940s, that ADHD was something that should be treated with therapy, with talk therapy, and often treatment of the mothers. So a whole lot. So too long didn't read, it's the mother's fault. That's the end of the story. But there was like in the 1940s, 50s, when they were trying to figure out like what schizophrenia was and what might cause it. Mm. There's this really great book called The Pathological Family by Deborah Weinstein. And she talks about how schizophrenia was defined as an illness caused by sort of imbalanced mothering, right? So it's too attentive, it's not attentive enough. There's some sort of negative dynamic between mother and son that is causing them, like as young adults, to develop schizophrenia, which is a very serious mental health illness and, you know, very troubling for a lot of people.
And by the way, let's just put out there, it has nothing to do with your parenting.
It has nothing to do with your parenting.
So if you are a parent of somebody who's living with schizophrenia,
oh my gosh,
please,
no. Yeah.
This is.
But yeah, and similarly with ADHD, it was framed as something that might result from parenting issues and particularly mothering issues.
Interesting. So I think, you know, going back to kind of what we were talking about in terms of the biases in diagnosis, you can see how that just kind of becomes perpetuated early. And then kids just figure out how to function in a system either well enough that they are able to be very highly successful in school or not. And then when people progress later in life, you know, the symptoms can look different, right? Because nobody's expecting you to sit on a carpet square for circle time when you're an adult, but you do have to do other things, right? So when you're going through young adulthood, it's a time of a lot of transitions where you're going to college potentially or moving out. And sometimes symptoms really come to the fore there. So, you know, for college students, kids who had more significant ADHD symptoms tend to be like less organized and less methodical and maybe have a little bit less self-control and tend to procrastinate more. So then again, that could impact kids' ability to function and be successful in school. And you know, in relationships, adults with ADHD tend to have shorter romantic relationships. Sometimes people have like less marital satisfaction or higher rates of divorce compared to adults without ADHD. And also sometimes have sexual behaviors that differ in terms of like less likely to use condoms consistently, more likely to use substances before sex. Again, kind of, I think, looking for that dopamine experience. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, having ADHD also can really impact friendships. And so adults with ADHD oftentimes have fewer social contacts and more loneliness, just because I don't know if it's because ADHD can cause behaviors that sometimes are considered like annoying, air quotes, annoying, like talking a lot or being unreliable or not being on top of your schedule, right? So missing dates or flaking out on dates. But, you know, if you're lonely, that's also going to have a huge impact on your quality of life.
I was just going to say, it sounds really isolating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really can
be. In so many ways.
So, you know, the other things that I was going to just mention in terms of some of the challenges of diagnosing and treating ADHD now, kind of in the after times, there is certainly the social media piece that I think brings people to the topic more frequently. Like maybe they had never even considered that they could have adult ADHD. And so they're thinking about it more. And then, you know, the way that the internet algorithm works is then you're just showed more and more and more things about adult ADHD. And so sometimes it becomes really difficult to ignore the more that you are reading about it.
Right.
You know, we talked about kind of the other things that could make it hard to find a diagnosis. And honestly, like COVID was not great for people with ADHD, right? Because all of the structures that usually keep people on track, like in the workplace, right? They have these external factors that keep them accountable and on track, just went away. And working from home is incredibly challenging because there's always something that's going to pull your attention, whether it's laundry or, you know, getting a snack or whatever it is. And then, you know, there's the medication piece. I think you kind of alluded to the shortages of stimulant medications. And I think there's a lot of discussion in the medical community about why that happened. And it continues to be really hard for people to get their ADHD medication.
Huh.
Some people think it's because there is this, it's all driven by social media and that everybody thinks that they have ADHD and they're getting prescriptions unnecessarily. And now there's not enough Adderall for anybody. Could that be part of it? Could people be getting diagnosed more? Maybe. I haven't really looked at the data. I think that there definitely are a lot more web-based mental health providers than there were previously. Again, I think the silver lining of COVID is that now there's a lot more resources available for people who want to do therapy online or do telemedicine, right? So that's a nice thing that has happened. And also it has really opened up this new field of telemedicine that, like, you can have an appointment with somebody who says that they are going to evaluate you for ADHD or autism or anxiety or depression and then prescribe you medications. And I don't know how thorough those evaluations are because I haven't ever really done one. But I think that increasing access to that sort of clinical realm allowed more people to get prescriptions.
Right.
And so there was this period of time where, like, nobody could get their stimulants, right? And it's like the worst possible thing that could happen to people with ADHD because it requires an enormous amount of executive function to, like, navigate that, right? Because you need to know. Right. And when I say executive function, I mean, like, executive function is like managing your time, planning, organizing your environment, right? Making sure that you have strategies to successfully, like, complete a predefined task. And those are oftentimes the things where we see huge impairments for people with adult ADHD. And so now you're in the situation where you've run out of your medication because you didn't have the executive function to plan ahead. And now the pharmacy says, sorry, we don't have your medication. And then you call your doctor's office and they say, well, you need to figure out where you can get it. So call around to all the pharmacies in town and see who has it and then let us know, right? And it's just this, it's like all the things that are really challenging make it especially, rough for people with ADHD. And then when you add on top of that, the fact that stimulants are a controlled substance, right? So you think about it, a controlled substance is a medication that can be misused or abused, right? And so these medications have been misused or abused in the past. So there are all these laws about how I can prescribe medications that are controlled and how patients can take them. So because of that, sometimes there are really strict guidelines that get put on patients. So sometimes clinics will have you sign a controlled substance contract, which says, like, you have to choose one pharmacy. You can only get it from this clinic, from nowhere else. We have the right to randomly drug test you. And if there's anything in your urine that shouldn't be there, then we're not going to prescribe for you anymore. Some clinicians won't prescribe any stimulants if you're using marijuana. And, you know, marijuana is legal in a bunch of states. So people are using marijuana. And it just can be very stigmatizing, right? When you go to the pharmacy to pick up your medication, you have to show your ID because it's a controlled substance. So all of this kind of can add to a humongous number of hurdles for people getting treatment. Right. And sometimes people are just like, well, fuck it. It's like, it's too hard. So I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, which is maybe, I don't know, like drinking a ton of coffee or procrastinating until the last minute, and that surge of adrenaline is going to serve as my Ritalin, basically.
Right. And I think that, like, just on what you just said, I think that I've noticed it, like, with students or with you know, colleagues or friends, very, very bright people, sort of super high functioning, and they've been like compensating for their ADHD for years. They found ways to like game the system, some game their own body system somehow, either through caffeine. And it's sort of like, oh, if you could just get that treated, just think about what you'll be able to do, which has been true for some of these folks that I've worked with who were sort of exhausted from having to put forth so much effort to get things done that they were fully capable of doing to start with. But just like the sitting down and the doing of it, there were like all these rituals and sort of all of these conditions that they needed to create for themselves in order to be able to work. So I'm talking about this in this very capitalistic productivity mode of like the reason why you need this is that you can get work done. But it was also like for their relationships, like being able to just sort of sit and be, like there wasn't this constant feeling, that constant tug wasn't there after getting some help for it. So that's important as
well. You know, sometimes people will talk about the ADHD tax. Have you heard about people talking about this? About how like food will rot in their fridge because they forget that it's there, or they'll like lose their keys. And so they'll have to like constantly get their keys replaced, or buying multiple things even though you already have it, right? And so there definitely is like an ADHD tax that, again, like over time makes it harder to function.
So I just learned so much about adult ADHD. And I feel like I'm, you know, learning from this conversation both that we need to advocate for ourselves when we go in and we know what our symptoms are, we know what we're feeling in our bodies, and to also try to find that clinician who's going to listen and be attentive to what all of those things are. And this is real.
It is real.
However it ends up happening that certain people have this, it is a real thing. And, you know, certainly painful if you're not getting the right care for it. So,
yeah. And I might just give a couple of like pro tips and resources for folks who are thinking about pursuing getting a diagnosis. I would say there are lots of wonderful resources online, and we can link to some in our show notes. But a couple of my favorites are Danny Donovan, who is I guess I would call them a content creator. I'm not 100% sure if that's a term that they would use for themselves. But the Anti-Planner is a planner that Danny Donovan put together that is, you know, a lot of people with ADHD have like bought all the planners thinking like, this is the thing that's going to fix me, right? Like, this is the thing that's going to help me function. And this planner is totally different. There aren't actually any days or weeks. And it just is, if you're feeling like you're having decision paralysis, there's an activity that you can do to help you get out of decision paralysis. She also does a lot of really great comics about ADHD that people can find really validating and hilarious. Also, How to ADHD is a wonderful resource. The person who runs this website has lots of hilarious and really helpful videos. I think she recently wrote a book, but sometimes it can be validating, and also, I don't know what the word is, like it can be such a relief to know that there are potentially strategies that you can use to help yourself function. And to be honest, you don't have to start medication for ADHD, right? Like there are a lot of wonderful things about having ADHD in terms of like creativity and having a like really diverse skill set. And, you know, multitasking is also often something that folks with ADHD do really, really well. And so figuring out how to harness those superpowers can be really great. Also, you know, if you have the money to spare, you can do formal testing, like neuropsych testing. You know, there are places locally here that I refer people to. It can be expensive. It can be, you know, like $400 or $500. And it's a pretty lengthy process. It's about like 3 hours-ish. But there are all sorts of different tests that are part of neuropsych testing that will look at things like memory and like how your sequential thinking works and how you are with math and language and distractibility. And they also would do screening for mood disorders. And so sometimes people who are trying to like prove to their clinicians that they have ADHD will go and have formal neuropsych testing and say, like, I did this testing. Someone has diagnosed me. Now, can we please pursue treatment? I think you could probably see how there would be a lot of disparity in who has access to that sort of testing. But I'm just saying that it's out there. Also, there are some people who, again, if you've got some money to burn, ADHD coaching is a thing where you can work with a coach to help you figure out either systems to put in place or barriers to decision making, help you maybe understand why you're procrastinating. Is there a reason behind it? Right. So there, again, that's a non-medication approach to managing ADHD that can be super, super helpful.
Well, awesome. I just learned so much from this conversation, and I'm excited to now go out into the world being a little more educated about ADHD. I don't know what you're doing later, but I think we need to get on that protest workout plan.
Yes.
This could be the life changer, Ronnie. This could be the thing that catapults us to fame.
And towards early retirement.
Yeah. This is our like Richard Simmons moment. Like amazing. We're going all in. I was going to say Jane Fonda, and I think she's awesome. That's right. I think Jane Fonda is really terrific. But I just felt like Richard Simmons was more on brand for our conversations here. Because it needs to be fabulous. Yes. Like we need to be, because his workouts were, he was just fabulous. And I think that that needs to be something we bring to our
maybe
protest
we can bring
well.
Like, bring the glamour and enthusiasm of Richard Simmons with the like politics of Jane Fonda.
Yeah. That's good. Like I am, you know, 147 years old and I am on the steps of Congress. She's amazing. She's not 147. But she is well into her 80s and, protesting the heck out of the last several years. And I really commend her for that. May she live to 147. She will still be on the steps of Congress protesting all the things that our country is getting wrong, and more power to her.
You've been listening to This Is Probably a Really Weird Question, which is created, hosted, and produced by Rebecca Davis and Ronnie Hayon.
You can learn more about us, read our show notes, and find links to resources on our website, www.reallyweirdquestion.com.
Follow us on Instagram at reallyweirdquestionpod.
Send us your really weird, not really, questions by emailing us at reallyweirdquestion@gmail.com.
Nora Carlson is our website guru and social manager.
Mick Finnegan is our sound engineer.
Mark Wurzelbacher composed and recorded our incredible theme music.
We are grateful for the financial support of the Phil Zwickler Charitable and Memorial Foundation Trust. We additionally thank the Foundation for Delaware County.
Please rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts to help other people find us in their feed.
Our website is also where you can find links to our fabulous merch, which helps support the show.
Thank you for listening, and keep on asking those questions.